something, start something a little different. I've been talking about how we finished the series, and then the last two Sundays we did kind of like standalone sermons. I'm going to go into a series, probably last us about a month or so, and it's going to be one of those obscure books, okay? So if you're going to find it in your Bible, you might have a little bit of a hard time. It's called Habakkuk. If you start from Matthew and you work your way back, I think it's about four or five books back into the Old Testament. This guy Habakkuk, who we really don't know too much about, I mean, if you look in commentaries, that's basically their commentary. We don't know anything about this guy except that he wrote this book, and we don't even know how to pronounce his name. I don't know if you ever noticed that, if you've ever gone to different churches or heard people talk about him. If you tell somebody after today and you go to another church or somewhere and you say, yeah, you know, we started to study Habakkuk. And they'll say, oh, you mean Habakkuk, yeah. You know? And you'll say, well, my pastor said Habakkuk, okay? And here's what you can tell them, okay? You can tell them that actually Habakkuk's name comes from the Arcadian language, which is an extinct Semitic language, and so nobody's really sure how to pronounce his name, okay? See, we do our studying over here. So, nobody really knows, but we're going to have to call him something, okay? So I'm going to go with Habakkuk, all right? If you want to use Habakkuk, go right ahead. And we're going to just read those first four verses to start. We're going to get through the first chapter this morning and then kind of work our way through in the weeks to come. Here's what he writes when he starts, very first verse of this little book of the prophet. And it says, the oracle which Habakkuk the prophet saw. And here's what he said. How long, O Lord, will I call for help? And you will not hear. Things haven't changed so much in 2,600 years, have they? 2,600 years ago, he wrote this. You may have even put that in your journal last night, huh? How long, O Lord, will I call for help and you will not hear? I cry out to you, violence, yet you do not save. What do you make me? Or why do you make me see iniquity and cause me to look on wickedness? Yeah, destruction and violence are all before me. Strife exists and contention arises. Therefore, the law is ignored. In the NIV, it says the law is paralyzed and justice is never upheld. For the wicked surround the righteous. Therefore, justice comes out perverted. I'm going to just give a couple principles that I extracted from this book, and here's the first one for the first four verses, and that is that following God often creates more questions than it does answers. Have you ever found that to be true? When you start following God, it seems like sometimes there's more questions than there are answers, and if you're just honest about it, and obviously Habakkuk is being brutally honest here, which is one of the things that's interesting about this book, about this prophetic book. Most prophets often are talking for God, if you read their books, you know, like, thus saith the Lord, judgment's coming, your day of reckoning is on the way, you better hang on. Habakkuk, instead of talking for God, he's talking to God, which is kind of interesting. It's a dialogue he's having here. He's praying. He's interacting with God, and he's talking to them, and he's just saying, God, how long are we supposed to hang in here and look at all this crazy stuff that's going on, all this violence and iniquity, how long? And there is wickedness everywhere that's going on in his day. There's wickedness that's going on inside the community that he lives, and there's wickedness going on outside the community where he lives. As far as inside his community, where he's at, known as Judah, okay, where the Jewish people lived, Israel had divided, and this particular group where he was at was Judah. And they had had a good king. Right about this time, though, he had died, Josiah. And his sons took over, and his sons were bad news. They were bad characters, wicked guys, and he was plunging their community into just craziness, anarchy, injustice, and they were terribly violent guys. And that's why in verse 4, Habakkuk says, "The just seems like the law, God, your law is being ignored. It's paralyzed. Nobody's obeying it. It's a mess inside our community." But as if that wasn't enough, if you look outside their community, it seemed even worse. Because outside their community was this merciless, evil empire, the Babylonian Empire. In some of your Bibles, it may refer to them as the Chaldeans. And they were just steamrolling over the continent, almost like Hitler's blitzkrieg of the 20th century, where they just Poland, and then it's the next one, and then France, and they just, and that's how they were doing, and they knew they were going to, it's just a matter of time. I can't imagine what that must feel like. I mean, it's one thing to have a surprise attack, which we've experienced with terrorism, but to know it's coming, and what do you do? That's what happened to my father-in-law. His mom somehow knew that the German lines were coming and told him to get out of there and sent him on his way, never saw his mom and 8 of his brothers and sisters again after that. Didn't even know how they died, just knew they didn't make it. Israel at this time, Judah at this time, is having that same kind of nerve-wracking feeling. Babylon's coming. It's terrible inside, and it's even worse when I look outside. God, how long are you just going to stand around while we're crying out for help? We need help. Why aren't you doing anything? Are you abandoning us? Why do you tolerate this? So God answers him in verse 5, which brings up the next principle, which is when God answers us, it often creates even more questions. Following God often creates more questions than it does answers. And then when he gives you an answer, it sometimes just seems to create even more questions. So he answers him like this. God says to him in verse 5, "Well, look among the nations, observe. Be astonished, wonderful, because I am doing something in your days. You would not believe it if you were told." Now that sounds kind of exciting. Sounds like revival's coming. He says, you know, you're not going to believe this. This is, you know, I'm about to do something. You won't even believe it. Really? God, what is it? Tell me. So he tells him, "For behold, I am raising up the Babylonians. I'm raising up the Chaldeans, that fierce and impetuous people who march throughout the earth to seize dwelling places which are not theirs." And then he just goes on for the next several verses describing how violent they are and how they just take over nation after nation mercilessly. And they're heading for their camp, and I'm raising up these Babylonians, and I'm going to raise up this most ruthless, bloodthirsty people that you've ever seen, and they're going to sweep across the world, and they're going to actually end up crushing your country as well. And you're like, what? That's the answer. It's almost comical the way God does it, because it's like, you know, God says, "All right, Habakkuk, you want an answer? I'll give you an answer, but you're not going to understand it. You're not going to believe it. All right? Listen, Habakkuk, I'll give you the answer, but you're not going to get it." And Habakkuk is like, "That's all right, you know, just tell me. I want to hear it. I want to know what you're doing, God." And God says, "Well, listen, if I tell you, you're not going to understand it." And Habakkuk says, "Well, just tell me, will you? Tell me what you're going to do." And God says, "Okay, I'll tell you." So then he tells him, and then Habakkuk goes, "I don't get it." And God says, "I told you you wouldn't get it." They don't understand. You know what it's like? I think I used this example last week too. It's like, If you have a three-year-old kid and they scream, why are they screaming? Because you just took something away from them. They were trying to drink it. I think it was Alyssa once went to try and drink the Pine Sol out of under our sink. We hadn't locked the child lock in time, but I got it out of her, grabbed it out of her hand. She didn't like it either. She wanted to drink it. She wanted to swig. You know what? Actually, I remember going to the hospital and visiting a parent because their, I think it was like a 2 or 3 year old, had gotten to the Pine Sol before they got to them. It was not pretty. The kid made it. But it's like they grabbed it, you grab it out of the hand, the kid screams, and they don't get it. They don't, what are you going to do? Sit down and try and explain to them about the chemical compound of Pine Sol and what it does to their, they're not going to understand it. They're not going to get it. You just have to take it away from them, and eventually they're going to have to start trusting you. Point being, the distance between an adult and a three-year-old isn't even close to the distance that exists between God and us. But yet the kids do a better job than we do because at least they start trusting their parents. We go through all this and we still have a hard time trusting God. And if we don't start trusting Him, we're gonna die spiritually, maybe even physically. Book by a lady named Evelyn Underhill wrote this book called These Strange Ashes. Interesting name, because isn't that how you kind of feel sometimes when you're following God? You're just kind of sitting in these strange ashes. But she says, if God was small enough to understand, He wouldn't be big enough to be worshipped. What's kind of cool about Habakkuk here is that he's not on either extreme. He's not on the legalistic religious extreme where it's like, listen, you can't question God. You don't ask Him kind of things. He might wipe you out. You can't ask, you know, what are you doing? You can't say that to God. He's obviously not doing that one. I mean, he comes out of the gate with some serious questions right away, so he's not doing that one. But on the other hand, he's not like this arrogant, you know, in a lot of ways, it's like New Yorkers. They just have this incredible, arrogant confidence about human reason and perception, and they'll look at anything that's going on, and if it doesn't make sense to them, then you know what? This is ridiculous. How could God be in the middle of this mess? How could I possibly believe in God? I don't believe in God. I'm out of here. They just don't, you know, they're not going to settle for it. It's ridiculous. They walk out, but you know what? Habakkuk's not doing either one of those things. He's questioning God, but he's not legalistic where he feels like he can't question Him, but he's not questioning God's existence. Look at verse 12. He refers to Him to the Lord, my God, the Holy One. Basically what he's saying, listen, I can't figure stuff out, but let's just face it. If I can't figure out life with you, God, then how in the world am I ever going to figure out life without you? Where else can I go? That's what Peter said. Lord, where else are we going to go? You've got the words of eternal life. Man, maybe I can't figure it out with you, but what, am I going to leave you? You think I'm going to start to figure it out better without you? But what's interesting is, God says, I'm bringing these Chaldeans, I'm bringing these Babylonians on you. And then He says this in verse 11, verse 10 and 11. He finishes up talking about how fierce their army is in verse 10. They mock at kings and rulers are a laughing matter to them. They laugh at every fortress and heap up rubble to capture it. Verse 11, then they will sweep through like the wind and pass on, but they will be held guilty. They whose strength is their God. Now try and understand that one. God says He raises up the Babylonians to come in and attack Judah, and then when they carry out what He raised them out to do, He says you're going to be held guilty for it. See, this is the age-old question. Well, how does that work? If God is raising up somebody
to carry out an attack, then how could he charge them guilty for carrying out the very thing that he set them out to do? I don't know. I'm out of here. No, I mean, these are the kind of questions. This is the age-old question. Where does it fall? We have the sovereignty, the total control of God, and we've got the free volition and will of man. And how did the two come together? And I think there's some things in our theology that you just have to leave some loose ends dangling. You can't just neatly tie them all up. You start going on some of these things. I always told Joel, one of my favorite answers from a professor at a seminary was when, you know, he would put some stuff out there, some of the mystery. There is mystery in the Bible, people. He's beyond our understanding. He says, love him with all your heart, mind, and soul. You're not going to be able to understand him with all your heart, mind, and soul. There's going to be plenty of stuff in your life where there's going to just be loose ends, and you're going to have to leave them out there. And this professor would read some of this stuff like that and just leave it hanging out there for them to wrestle with, to pray through. And then somebody would say, well, professor, you know, if you took that to its logical end, and he'd cut in and say, only a fool would. Next question, please. I'm going to use that one. You know, when you guys ask, only a fool would. Next question, please. See, there's stuff in there that we're not going to totally figure out. God is totally in control, but at the same time, there is a free will of man. See, there's parts where you see God just working sovereignly, but then you see other parts where God will say something like, we saw that scripture last week, I long to gather you, Jerusalem, in their rebellion. He said, I long to gather you like a hen does her chicks. But then he doesn't say, but I made you not willing. He says, but you were not willing. So how does that all fit together? Leave it dangling. I'll tell you this much. God will use you. Third principle. God will use you, whether it's in your rebellion or your obedience. You'll be used. And the fact is that God can accomplish his goodwill out of rebellious actions doesn't mean that that excuses you of your actions. That's why he says, but you will be held guilty. Even though he uses you in your rebellion to carry out his plan, doesn't excuse you from your rebellion. That's right. Jesus said offenses may come. As a matter of fact, he said offenses will come, but woe to them by whom they come. Sins do cause grace to abound, Paul says, but that doesn't mean that it makes us an excuse for continuing to sin. The crucifixion, here's a great line, the crucifixion itself is the best as well as the worst of all historical events, is it not? But the role of Judas still remains evil. Here's how C.S. Lewis put it. He says, the obedient man serves God as a son, the rebellious as a tool. For you will certainly carry out God's purpose however you act. But it makes a difference to you whether you serve like Judas or like a John. You will serve him. I think that was one of Bob Dylan's songs that he came out when he went through a time where he had an experience with Jesus Christ. And he wrote a song and he said, you're going to have to serve somebody. You will serve somebody. Says you're going to serve God. He's serving the devil, but you know what? You'll still serve God as a tool. But if you're serving God, you'll serve him as a child. You're either going to serve him as a son or a tool. God says Babylon is not serving me as a son right now, but they're going to be my tool. I'm bringing them in, and they're steamrolling over the land, and they're going to come into you, Judah. And through their injustice and violence, I'm going to bring salvation to the world, and you're not going to understand it. Habakkuk says, you're right, I don't understand it. I don't know what's going on here. As a matter of fact, God, you know what I feel like? He uses the example of a fish swimming around helplessly in water, not knowing that that hook is baiting him, or that he's about to swim into the fisherman's net. His demise is going to be the fisherman's profit. His demise is going to be the fisherman's nutrition. He says, that's how I kind of feel. You know, that's how Babylon is with all of us. And God, I just don't understand. I don't know where you are. God, what are you doing? Do you remember back at Easter? I said that one of the ways often you can understand the story in its best way is if you know the end of the story. You watch one of those movies and it's like kind of strange and the whole thing's going on, and then all of a sudden, bang, it has this total shocking surprise ending. You got to be like, are you kidding me? That's how this thing ends? And so what do? You have to watch the movie again, because you have to watch it in light of its ending. So what do you get? You put it back in and you watch the movie again, and you're like, oh, wow, now I see. Now I know why he's doing that. Oh, that's why she said that. And the whole thing takes on a whole nother light, and you understand it completely more. You see into it. Well, I think there's something that we often see in these Bible stories because we can understand them. We can now understand Habakkuk's situation in light of the end of the story. We're 2,600 years down the road. We've got some advantages here. There's some things that we're going to be able to see. One of them is when Babylon came into Judah, they destroyed the place, but they took them back captive to Babylon. They didn't just kill them, they took them as prisoners and they brought them back to Babylon. Remember, we talked about that last week. Did you know that there were still some Jewish people in Babylon up until 2003? They'd been hanging out there for 2,600 years. They were hanging out there. And then in 2003, there were still 120,000 of them in Babylon. And then they left. Now, according to what I just read, there's 6 Jewish people left living in Babylon, which is modern-day Iraq. 120,000 were still there up until 11 years ago. Kind of interesting, because God says in the last days, I'm going to gather them all in Israel. They finally, the last of them, have left Babylon and they're back in Israel. Interesting what God's doing. But at this time, God was bringing them out of Israel into Babylon. That's what he said, and I'm going to use this army to do it. Why? Why can't we just stay in our nation? Why are you bringing us out to Babylon in exile in Babylon? You know why? After the exile, there was a time when they were finally, remember, after 70 years, King Cyrus says, I'm going to let you go back. And a bunch of them went back to Jerusalem to rebuild the temple and resettle Jerusalem again and fix it from how it had been destroyed 70 years earlier. But a lot of them, most of them didn't go back. The majority of them stayed. And they went all to different countries, and they kept their faith, though. They kept their faith, and what did they do? They didn't live in Jerusalem, so you know what they did? They built synagogues wherever they lived. Wherever their community settled, all throughout the known world at that time, they would make a synagogue so that they could go and have a place to worship. Those were the actual synagogues that not only the Jewish people went to, but then these Jewish people who worshiped a monotheistic God, one God in the midst of a people that were completely saturated with the concept of a polytheistic God, a multiple gods, there they are worshiping at different synagogues. Pagan people started to believe in the God of the Bible. They were called Gentile God-fearers. And when Christianity sprung up, these were the places that the missionaries could go to preach. If you look at the book of Acts, that's what happened. That's where Paul went. Where is he? Was he going to go into the temple of Apollos? He goes into the the Jewish synagogue of the area. None of these synagogues would have ever been there if they had not been taken exile by the Babylonians. And he goes in there and he gets to preach to them. And it was a basis where which he could start to speak to all the different people. And what historians say is that the pagans weren't interested. They couldn't start with talking or witnessing directly to the pagans, but they would go into the synagogues because the people who were most open to the gospel, imagine, at this time were the Jewish people, but even more so were the Gentile converts, the God-fearing Gentiles, and that's how God used to spread his message. In other words, the Babylonians thought they were invading Judah, thought they were invading the Jewish people to destroy their religious culture, when in fact God was using it to spread their religious culture. He takes what we want to do, or what the rebellious people, the people who aren't following him, and they think they're doing something and they're devising their own plan, but God is turning it right back on them and carrying out his own plan. We're going in here to destroy the religious culture here, and he takes them and uses it to spread that religious culture all throughout the Middle East at this time. The Babylonians come up and they take them out, and then you look at history. Don't forget, we're 2,600 years down the road, so we've got plenty of stuff we can look at here, what God did. Not only did he bring the Jewish people, you got the Babylonian Empire, they bring the Jewish people out of Israel so that there's synagogues all over the place and begin to spread the message of the one God. There's one God. But then you get the next empire is the Greeks. What do? They demand that everybody be able to speak the same language. You know what that means? You could write a book and everybody be able to read it, like the Bible. And most people couldn't read, but if you speak it in Greek, you were had to learn Greek so you'd understand it. For the first time in world history, not only has God brought the Babylonians into Judah to bring the Jewish people so that eventually they put synagogues everywhere, everybody understands the same language, so whatever synagogue you go to, you'll be able to understand what they're saying when they give the message. And not only that, then you have the Romans next, and they take over. What do? They make a system of roads all over the place so you can get all over the empire in peace, right? Pax Romana. So you could go wherever you wanted. So God has got this whole big plan, none of which Habakkuk can see. But we understand the story in light of its ending. Trust God. He knows what he's doing. God is on the throne beyond what we can even imagine. You can't fight God. Thought they were invading Jerusalem, but God was bringing Jerusalem to invade them. They thought they were invading Jerusalem, and God was allowing them to invade Jerusalem so he could bring them back over into Babylon and invade them. That's what even made it possible for the wise men to come from the east when Jesus was born. Why were there wise men that knew the concept of a Hebrew Messiah? Because they'd been witness to. Jerusalem was invaded and ended up invading Babylon. There were people looking even for the coming of the Messiah. Made it into the New Testament. See, this happens all the time. I was reading something about right at the end of World War II, China becomes communist, right? It says that all the Western church was absolutely mortified because they had spent 100 years sending missionaries into China. The Hudson Taylors of the world. Mothers and had sacrificed their sons to go off to China. Listen, when you sent a son off to China in 1820, you weren't going to see him again. It wasn't like he could hop on a buddy pass, and come back. You know, it's like, man, you ever read the journal of Hudson Taylor's mom when she said goodbye to her son? You can't read it without getting ripped up. She talks about going on the ship to say goodbye to her son. Was giving her son for the gospel to go to China and witness. She talks about straightening his covers for the last time on the bed in his, only like a mom could talk.
you know, and saying goodbye to her son. And then Hudson Taylor wrote how he heard the wails of his mom off on the dock while his ship was pulling away. A wail that only a mother could give as she sacrifices her only son for the gospel. And this were the kind of sacrifices that were made for China. And then what happens? Communism comes in and kicks out all the missionaries. We're like, oh man, a century of work just wasted, thrown away. Well, that's our Habakkuk viewpoint, isn't it? God, what are you doing? But what is God doing? He's turning the Christian work over from the Western missionaries to the Chinese himself, who did such a greater job. Now Christianity became indigenous right within their own culture, and here we are not even 100 years later. What are we, about 70-some years later? It's estimated that there is over 100 million Chinese believers, and it's growing at an unprecedented rate. If it continues at this rate, as little as 15 years, there will be more Chinese Christian believers than the entire population of the United States. That's a force to be reckoned with. And these aren't just pew warmers, man. That's God. What do you mean? Habakkuk, what do you mean? Well, what do I mean? Because I can't see in my own time either. See, when you say God doesn't make sense, that don't make sense. It don't. You can't say that. You can't say God don't make sense. That don't make sense. Look at years later. Here we go, okay? Acts 13. A little over 600 years later, we're in Acts 13. I mean, don't belittle that. That's a long time, okay? 600 years, okay? 600 years later, here's Paul in Acts 13. Where do we see him speaking? In a synagogue that would have never been there had the Babylonians never invaded Jerusalem and had the Jewish people spread out and start setting up synagogues. And here he is preaching the gospel in one of them. He's there because the events that Habakkuk questioned took place. He says this, Acts 13 and 26, brothers, children of Abraham, that's the Jewish people, and here they are, you God-fearing Gentiles. They were there. None of them would have been there had this thing that Habakkuk was yelling at God about. If God would have listened to Habakkuk, this would have never happened. Good thing he doesn't listen to us. Right? I often say that. I say, I've said this a bunch of times now because it just really hit me how God has a safety valve on his prayer, on our prayers. You know, because we'll pray. So I'm glad that God didn't answer all my prayers, I tell you. You know, I told you that. When I told my dad when I was 8 years old I wanted to be a cowboy. Could you imagine if my dad answered that request when I was 18 and ready to go to college? I said, okay, Dad, you got my tuition? What? I bought you a whole ranch over here. I got no money left. You told me you wanted to be a cowboy. Aren't you glad he doesn't always listen? He's got a safety valve. He'll answer you because James says we have not because we ask not. So that means you got stuff that you don't have because you simply didn't ask him. That makes you be like, shoot, man, I'm going to pray today. What do I want? But then 1 John says if you ask anything according to his will, that puts a safety valve on it. I think it was Keller that said, I'm sure that Mary must have looked up at Jesus crucified on the cross and said, God, prayed. God, you can't let this happen to my son. Thank God he answered her prayer how she would have prayed if she knew everything that God knew. See, sometimes God answers your prayer and sometimes he gives you something even better, even though it may look a whole lot worse. I think that's what he did with Habakkuk here. So here's Paul preaching in a synagogue because God didn't listen to Habakkuk. God was not convinced by Habakkuk that he was doing some real stupid stuff. And he went through with it. And so now we have Paul in this synagogue that's only there because of the events that took place during Habakkuk's time. And he says, listen to me,
you Jewish people and you Gentile God-fearers, it is to us that this message of salvation has been sent. The people of Jerusalem and their rulers did not recognize Jesus. Yet in condemning him, they fulfilled the words of the prophets. In their rebellion, the very people that knew this book better than anybody ended up going completely diametrically opposed to his word, but in so doing, God made sure his will was done anyway. That's a serious safety valve, man. We're not going to detour what God's got in mind. Don't. He knows what he's doing. He's going to bring it to pass. And he says, even in condemning them, even though they didn't receive the message and they condemned them, they ended up fulfilling the words of the prophet. And then he says this, take care that what the prophet said does not happen to you. And then he quotes Habakkuk right there in the synagogue that wouldn't have been there if God had listened to Habakkuk. And he quotes Habakkuk's words and he says, listen, watch out. Don't be like scoffers like Habakkuk said, for I am going to do something in your days that you would never believe even if somebody told you. See, what Paul is saying is the thing God said to Habakkuk, that principle, that God's wisdom is, it just turns all of our logic on its heels. You want to understand God's logic? The best way I've ever heard it described is, look at the cross. He brings light out of darkness. He brings justice out of injustice. It blows your mind. He brings us justice out of wrong and evil and suffering. What it is God demonstrates time and time again in this book that his ultimate triumph over evil. How does he triumph? What is his ultimate triumph over evil? Is that God uses it for good. He just tilts it around. That's how it is right now, and enjoy it while you can. It's a dispensation of grace. Right now, his cross is reigning, and he uses all the evil and turns it on its head and uses it for good. Even his own son being crucified on the cross. That's the ultimate demonstration. Now, there's going to come a day when it's no longer through the cross and through the dispensation of grace. Just read the book of Revelation. It's a little scary. But he brought the cross first, because if he brought his power first and wiped out all sin, I always told you this, it's not me, it's Keller that comes. Listen, any of this stuff that you think sounds really good, it's not me. All right, you find it some way. God gives. If God came in power and not the cross first, and he wanted to just wipe out all sin, nobody here that I know of, we're gone. Smoke! How am I going to have anybody left to go to church if I just come and wipe out sin? I got to take care of sin first. So let me come. I'll pay the sin penalty for sin first. That way you're saved and I can show up and you're still here in church. And how am I going to do that? I'm going to take evil and turn it on its head and use it for good. I'm going to take this Babylonian army and they're going to come in and invade Judah, and I'm going to use that to set a platform for my message of salvation to be delivered to the world. And I'm going to allow the violent destruction of their forces to actually set up the foundation for salvation to be delivered to the entire world. I'm going to take the destruction, the violent, unjust destruction of my own son, and turn it on its head and establish salvation through that. And what is he doing in your life? What is it that you're just saying, God, I don't get it. What is going on here? He's going to take that thing and listen, you know what this shows you? This book shows you dark times come on everybody. Even to those who don't deserve it. Otherwise, how could it have happened to Jesus? And it came on him. And you know what it means? Dark times come on you. Doesn't mean that God has abandoned you. That's what it means. And remember this. Whatever God is doing, whatever is happening, he wants you to know that he's in the midst of it. So he says to you, Trust me. Believe in me. Look to me. Look to me. Why don't we just stand? And whatever it is you're dealing with, you need to bring it back to the cross and understand what that cross says to you. He's going to take whatever that thing that's coming against you right now, and he's going to turn it on his heels and display his ultimate triumph of good coming out of that evil. How about that line that God's grace is most cleverly disguised at most times when it comes into your life as impossible situations? That's just how he works. Joel, whatever you got on your heart, let's just...